Welcome to AIM On Air, the official podcast of the Association for Intelligent Information Management. Founded in 1944, AIM is dedicated to advancing the information management industry. We represent a vibrant global community of information leaders committed to driving exceptional business outcomes through information management fueled by technology like AI and automation. You can learn more at AIIM.org. I'm AIM President and CEO Tori Miller Liu, CIP. And I am so excited for our guest today. She is a proven software development leader with experience delivering successful products on time and supporting Fortune 500 clients. She is an architect and technologist with deep experience in enterprise content management and business process management. She previously served as the director of software development for the FileNet Corporation, and she recently celebrated her ninth year with IBM and currently serves as a program director and senior development manager of software development at IBM. Please welcome Lauren Mays. Lauren, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here.
I can't believe 9 years at IBM. That's great.
Actually, that's wrong. It's 15. It might be 15 or 17 now. It's been since what, 2006 or 2007 was when we actually closed in 2007. So
okay, I was reading LinkedIn wrong. That's impressive.
Yeah, I guess I haven't updated that.
Okay, I'm a little curious. This is not one of the questions that I sent you, but now I'm curious. What has kept you at a company for 15 years?
I really enjoy the space and I enjoy the customers. And I've tended to bounce around and do a lot of different things. So, you know, I started in development, I was an architect, I was a development manager, then I went back to an architect. And then, you know, now I'm actually managing the product management team. So I like the work. It's fun, it's enjoyable, love working with customers. So I've just stayed around.
Right. And I think the other thing that I'm very impressed with and inspired by is your career as a woman in tech. In my experience, because I'm a former CIO, I've not met that many women who are software developers.
What
has that been like as part of your career?
You know, it's interesting. At IBM and even at FileNet, we've always had a good number of women, you know, in key roles. I mean, it's never as many, you know, as it is men, but I've had quite a few, I would say, mentors and, you know, people that I've been able to look up to over the years. So, you know, for me, it's been a pretty positive experience.
Do you have any words of advice for younger women who are maybe entering the technology field or interested in software?
You know, for me, it's just, you know, at the beginning, it was a lot of put your head down and do the work, you know, do good work, and then you will be noticed. And then the other thing I think that is important is, you know, establish relationships, you know, with other people, men and women, right? You know, people who can help progress your career. I think that's always a really good thing to do. And a lot of times those of us who are technically inclined don't do that or don't want to do that. They want to sit and, you know, do their work. So I actually struggled with that in my early days, but, you know, really came to understand the value of that, you know, over time. So definitely recommend that you get out there and talk to people and, you know, find out what's out there.
And hopefully, I know early in my career, being a part of an association helped me do that.
Yeah.
I was at a small organization and I met people who were in my field.
Yes. Getting into, you know, groups that are outside of your immediate company. Yeah. I think that's a great advice.
So switching gears a little bit, let's talk about the industry we're in. I mean, you've spent years, decades in information management, business process, and AI now, especially at IBM, which was one of the leaders in AI. What do you think is remarkable about the last year and a half or so since generative AI became so viral? And where do you see the industry headed?
Yeah, good question. So, you know, in some ways, things haven't changed. You know, what we're trying to do, there's a common thread. You know, when I first started, it was the paperless office, right? You know, that was the thing. But now, you know, in my view, just finding ways, you know, to make knowledge workers more productive is just going to have the biggest impact, you know, in the coming years. And, you know, there are so many things that are, you know, inefficient in the day-to-day life of people like myself, you know, and other knowledge workers. You know, knowledge work obviously can encompass lots of different roles, everything from a, you know, a loan officer to a lawyer to a product manager like myself to county employees processing permits. But there's so many things that are in our day-to-day lives that make us inefficient, you know, email, Slack, you know, constant interruptions, just finding anything, you know, with all the information out there, finding things. And so, you know, the reason I think this will have a big impact is really, you know, also based upon some work that IBM has done in terms of looking at studies from various sources. One, you know, in particular from McKinsey that talks about how, you know, productivity growth has been slowing for decades. And, you know, with a 1 point decline, I think it is, since 2005. And this is in the US plus, you know, other developed markets as well. And on top of that, the global, you know, workforce is also shrinking, you know, so this is going to limit economic output. So unless we can really increase that productivity for these employees, you know, we're going to be in trouble, right? And, you know, there's also, you know, there's other studies. I think there's one from, I think it was from Korn Ferry that talks about how many industries are facing these, you know, these deficits, these talent deficits. You know, this is in things like finance, technology, manufacturing. And so, you know, again, our ability to automate, you know, especially knowledge work is really going to be needed to counter those trends. You know, and at IBM, you know, we believe that companies can effectively apply automation, and now intelligent automation has been the major shift. And, you know, AI has been around for a long time. You know, we had another big boom in AI, what was it, around 2016. But it is different now, right? There's, with generative AI, the technology is really getting so much better that it really does become possible to really make, you know, significant improvements and gains. But just the technology, you know, isn't enough. You know, you have to do it in the context of automation and really trying to improve the overall, you know, productivity of folks. And, you know, within my own area, you know, so my team is responsible for content services, you know, so doc management, enterprise content management, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, what we've been working on is really how do we inject that intelligence into processes where people are interacting with content. But clearly, you know, it's a lot broader than just interacting with content. As I mentioned, there's so much inefficiencies in our workflow, you know, people sitting in email or Slack all day, handling requests from others, kind of keeping it all in their head about, you know, what they need to do about XYZ, you know, requests that comes in. And, you know, it's really inefficient. And so, you know, what we're doing now at IBM, and a lot of vendors are doing, is really injecting intelligence into our software, you know, this existing systems that we have. You know, for example, you know, in a content management system, it could be the ability to, you know, ask questions about a set of documents, you know, that are part of a case you're handling, and to be able to summarize those documents or extract important information from the documents that you, you know, may just be sitting there inside, and you users may have to sit and manually review this stuff all day. And now they can ask the questions and get at that much more easily. And so this notion of adding AI to existing systems, we call that, we have a term for that at IBM called plus AI, right? So you're adding AI to existing systems. But I think one of the things that I think is really exciting and that will be kind of the future is how can we update those tools? So really AI is kind of built in from the beginning. You know, you're using AI to actually design all the interactions, or, you know, and this can be everything from, you know, end users using the tools to developers, or even, you know, business analysts using the tools to build out processes and workflows. And so I think that's really going to be what we see as the real innovations going forward. And we have a really good example of, so a lot of this stuff we do internally ourselves, you know, within our own organization. Mm-hmm. And we have this tool that we've been using called Ask HR. And so, you know, I've been at IBM a while, as like we talked, and I've been a manager, and, you know, we've had many different tools that managers have to use to go deal with employee kind of situations, right? And while we had lots of improvements over time, we've moved to, you know, off the shelf HR systems that, you know, do a lot of the work. It's still really hard to find because there's always these internal tools. And it's really, you know, you get emails that have some information, you have some information in these internal tools. And so with this new tool, I can just go into it and say, when is salary planning due? As an example. So rather than go hunting and pecking through my email or trying to find a website, I just go to this one place. I say, when is salary planning due? It'll answer the question. It'll provide me that information, which is really helpful. I use this thing all the time. The other thing that it can do, which I think is kind of the next level, is also it can do things, right? So I can say, well, I need to transfer an employee to another group. I can go in and ask it, transfer employee to a new manager. And it'll say, oh, here's all your people. Who would you want to transfer? And it'll actually guide me through that process. And so, you know, that's an example of a typical workflow that somebody may do, you know, within their or as part of their job that can really be done much more easily and much more efficiently.
And that particular tool, is that for IBM, is that an example of the Plus AI application, or is that an example of an AI first application?
It's an AI first application, right? It's an AI first. Now, you know, it's evolved over time, but, yeah. You know, it's built on some technology we have called Watson Orchestrate, which mm-hmm. helps to, you know, build out these chat interfaces, essentially. But you're not just building a chat interface that like searches into a document repository that, you know, you get answers. It also integrates with what they're called skills, but it integrates with workflows that allow you to actually go do things, right? So you can create and build systems that carry out tasks, you know, in addition to just kind of asking questions and getting information. That's definitely this AI plus.
So with it being an AI first application, what ethical and governance frameworks do you all use? Because when you're talking about HR data, you're talking about sensitive salary information, probably yes. personal health information.
Yeah.
How do you secure that data and make sure that your staff feels like they can trust this application?
Yeah, great question. So this system knows who I am, right? And it knows, and you know, security is applied all along the way. So I don't get access to anything that I don't have access to, right? And so so that's step one, right? So basically, as I come into the system, it says, oh, you're Lauren, you're a manager, you know, because all of this is part of our data and our, you know, our backend systems. And so it's all integrated with that. And so that's one way. The other way is that, you know, so all that has to be built into those systems, you know, you have to build in the security, you have, you know, that's not kind of magic. It has to be available to be there, right? You can't, you know, I'll talk about another tooling we have around in this area, but, the key is having that security built in. And it, you know, knowing what you can and can't, you know, do. And it's really applying the same rules that you applied to these other systems you have to this new technology. It's not like you're just building a large language model and you're throwing everything in there and everybody has access to every bit of information. That it's not, it doesn't work that way, right? It's very controlled in terms of, you know, what you have access to.
That's interesting. So it's almost like, if you want an AI first application, what I'm getting from that is you also need to start with the fundamentals. You need to understand how to build privacy first and security first. And
absolutely. That doesn't go away. Absolutely. Yeah. All of that has to be part of these tools, right? You can't just ignore those kinds of things.
So, I mean, IBM has the luxury of having in-house developers and AI engineers who can build this kind of stuff.
Right.
Before, you talked about essentially two waves of how enterprises are probably going to be adopting AI. I agree with you that that first wave is really, it's not going to be an on-off switch. You're going to have existing providers, systems that will integrate AI. And we've seen that with IBM, with Microsoft, with other HubSpot, Salesforce, everyone's integrating AI into the existing platform. That I think is easier for me as a CEO and other organizations to wrap their heads around. It's like, okay, I have this tool that I'm already paying for. You're adding a new feature. I might pay extra for it. I might not, but it's in a tool I already understand. The AI first applications have me a little puzzled. As a CEO, as a leader, how do you think about that? Am I hiring someone to build it, or what? I don't have developers, so what does that mean for me?
I mean, it's one thing we always emphasize is we don't expect people to just go over and use AI first, right? We expect people to be using their existing tools. You're not going to go rebuild everything, right? You know, and we wouldn't want you to, right? You know, we know how expensive that is. We know how much it costs to, you know, redo things that you already have. So the idea is both are critically important, right? And so we would not suggest that you would just go to this other thing. However, you know, there are new applications you may be building or new capabilities, or, you know, customer service is the classic example, right? So many people are using AI for customer service kind of applications, right? And so for those things that you may not have, I mean, this Ask HR is actually another good example of, you know, most people, they don't necessarily have something that's kind of built on top of their HR systems to go make it easier to use your HR systems, right? And so it's eking out that little extra bit of, you know, productivity that you can. And so that's our message, right? You know, absolutely use your existing tools, add AI, but then, you know, you can also go use these new tools to start automating perhaps things that you hadn't automated before. Or maybe they're just new for you, right? You don't already have those things automated within your particular organization. And our goal too is to make that at a price point that you can, you know, that many customers could afford, right? So it's not just the huge banks and such that can use these tools, right? It's they're targeted to, you know, mid-range customers.
What I find so refreshing about that lens and that approach is there's so much fear mongering in the media about the digitization of labor and how AI is going to replace workers. Just now and before, when you were talking about how your IBM and you are focused on improving productivity, what it sounds like to me is you're actually focused on the gaps, on the things that no one, no system, no person was really doing, because maybe the volume of data was too much or there were too many disparate systems. Is that accurate? Like, is that how
it really is. It's all about, you know, people are going to be part of the system and they need to make these decisions, but how can you help them make these decisions a little faster? You know, how can you have that, get the information to them more readily, right? And so that's all that's absolutely where we're focusing.
So tell me a little bit more then about human intervention, because I have been asked in the last few months about how necessary humans are for even preparing data for AI. Like, I've had debates where I've been told, nope, you actually don't need a human to do any kind of categorization or normalization, which I believe is false based on where the technology is. I think you do need some human intervention, but what are you seeing in terms of how do humans control and manage AI, and what is their level of input?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's many different levels of that, right? Everything from, you know, the building these systems to the AI itself, getting the data available for the AI, to looking at the results of what the AI tells you, right? You know, if you have a Q&A and it provides you an answer. we are not at the point where humans can just ignore it and we can just do what it says, right? That's just not a reality, right? You know? So, you know, absolutely. Are there certain things that we could do more and more of, you know, like, for example, it's, I mean, the code generation is an example of something that's, you know, we have this ability to take a COBOL program and turn that into a new kind of program, but that's really more automation, right? You know, and again, it's also a starting point. You know, we have this ability to say, oh, let's say you have a workflow spec that defines how you're going to go do a workflow. Well, you can go create, you know, automatically create a workflow for that, but you're still going to have to go actually use it, test it, have people interact mm-hmm. with it and make sure that it's, you know, working as expected. And so, you know, we really do view it as augmenting what humans do, and that, you know, you're not going to remove humans from the picture. Again, you know, as always, there's always certain things that will become easier and easier for the machine to do, right? But, you know, there's so much opportunity. there's so many scenarios where a human needs to be in the picture.
And ultimately, math is incapable of being ethical. You need
absolutely
ethical intervention.
Yeah, you have to have processes and procedures in place to understand, first of all, I mean, you know, where is the AI coming from? You know, and that's you have to have all that in place for sure.
And where is the AI coming from? But also, where is the data source coming from? Where is your
that's exactly right. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Absolutely. Yes.
And how do you think generative AI in particular has changed perspectives on unstructured data?
Well, I think that with generative AI, you know, in my view, it's really more about people are much more aware of, well, what did this generative AI model get trained on? Do I know? You know, do I know where it came from? And we see that becoming more and more important. And so if you look at what we've been doing, so we've got this, you know, so far I've been talking about how we're kind of adding AI to our various applications. And we're also building new products that allow you to kind of build new workflows and applications using AI first. But at the core of all that is, you know, your AI platform, right? You know, your actual models, and how do you govern those models, and what's the data that's in those models? And so again, at IBM, we have a platform, it's called Watson X, and that's where we provide all of that. So, you know, I'm talking about all the different tools we have that are using that AI. We're all using kind of the same underlying infrastructure for AI, you know, across IBM. Mm-hmm. And there's a really good reason for doing that, right? Because first of all, that's where the knowledge and understanding of AI is, even within our own organization. You know, we have a whole group of people, both in development, research, and in product, who, you know, live and breathe this stuff every day. And what this platform consists of is it's called WatsonX.ai. And so that's one piece of it that allows you to use either, you know, IBM has built foundation models, large language foundation models, where we have all along being very clear on where is the data coming from that we're training this on. You know, we publish results, we have papers that are regularly updated that really explain what's in this thing, how did we train this model. We also can use open source models, right? So if you want to bring your own model into our WatsonX.ai and you want to train it yourself with your data, right? And so that's what a lot of customers are very interested in, right? It's like, okay, well, I don't really want to train my model on the internet, right? I want to train it on my documents. And so that's what this whole model allowed you to do. It allows you to use IBM's model. It allows you to use open source models. It allows you to train your own models. So that's the AI piece of it. But then in addition, on this platform, there's what's called WatsonX.data. And so that provides a whole set of tools for preparing data for AI, you know, preparing data, mm-hmm. interacting with data in various systems, you know, in order to, you know, inject that into the model. And then there's also WatsonX.governance. And this is the piece that's really important because it's really the element that is providing methodology and a practice for how do you actually direct, manage, and monitor the AI activities in your organization. So that can be everything from what goes into your models, but also your use of the AI, you know, in your applications. And so, you know, this is our vision of how you deal with all of the things that everyone's worried about with AI, like, you know, explainability, where did this answer come from? You know, ethics, yeah. Bias, trust, all those things that are, you know, a concern to and, you know, valid, real concerns that we need to address. You know, and our view is these are concerns. They're very real concerns. We need to help provide tools that help our customers more easily, you know, and provide them guardrails and guidelines to go apply those. But you need to go do that, right? We can't ignore it, right? Because it is here, and, you know, it will add a tremendous amount of, you know, we believe, and I believe, you know, myself, that really this technology is, you know, it's revolutionary and in a better state than it's ever been. And it will really help our customers be more, you know, competitive and, you know, deal with all the things I mentioned earlier about labor shortage and all that. So, I think it's, you know, our view is you must deal with those ethics and governance topics. That's just a given, you know, and we're all on a journey to figure that out, right? Nobody's figured it all out yet, but, you know, we're definitely committed to continuing that journey with our customers and providing, you know, that guidance and tooling to help do that.
And what I like about that approach too is that it's infinitely more practical than a lot of the content that you're seeing right now is around, okay, how do you write the policy? How do you communicate the policy? Which is great. But at the end of the day, how do I measure whether or not my staff followed that policy? Right. How do I track this? Yeah. What good is a policy if you can't actually measure it and see how effective it is and have the capability of enforcing it? So I do think, especially amongst executives, I am hearing a little bit of angst around, okay, we've talked about strategy, we've talked about understanding AI, and we've done that. Now what's next? And how are you responding to that? Are you seeing that kind of angst, and how are you,
absolutely,
I guess, people to something more productive?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And, you know, our response to it is really this Watson X strategy, right? This AI data governance, you know, and so that's our response to it. We've delivered offerings to help do those things, you know, to manage that, the governance. But, you know, honestly, what we're doing is we're working with our customers. Like, we're all on this journey together. You know, we haven't figured it out yet. And so our view is we're on the journey to figure it out with our customers. And, you know, we're committed to continually updating, you know, adding new capabilities that really try to address these concerns. So that's really
helpful. And right now, when you're talking to customers or potential customers, what are you hearing as the biggest barriers to AI adoption or AI success? What's coming up?
Yeah, it really is those four things I was mentioning. Explainability. How do I explain where I got my answer from? What are the ethics of it? You know, looking for, you know, bias. You know, is there bias in these models? Is it giving me answers that are, you know, inaccurate or biased? And trust, you know, how do you get trust of both your customers, your employees, that, you know, in what this AI is doing? So those are the things that we hear about the most.
And I guess of those, it feels like trust would be the game stopper.
Yeah.
If you can't trust it, how do you move forward?
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it is how you view what it's telling you, right? And I think this is a hard thing, right? I don't think it's necessarily an easy thing, but in some way, and I'll use the example that we have here at IBM and that Ask HR app that I mentioned. We have a tool that will suggest a range of salary increases for a person, right? It'll basically say, based upon X information, we recommend you give this employee a raise between, you know, whatever it is, 2 and 7%, 3 and 5, 5 and 7, whatever. But part of the way is the way it talks about it, right? It doesn't say, you know, give the person this much, right? This is what they deserve. It's explained. It says, based upon the employee's geographic region, you know, pay information for that region, for this job role, for this yet level of experience, this is, you know, or for the demand for the role, right? You know?
Yeah. So
it takes all those pieces of information as input to this model, and it tells you about it. It tells you, well, based upon this information, we're recommending, and the range is important too, right? It's not saying, you know, X percent. It's saying
this exact number. Yeah.
Exactly. So I think a huge part of it is how do we present the information to the people who are consuming it, right? And, you know, I know there's worry about, well, you can present it anyway and they'll just be lazy and they'll just go do, you know, whatever, right? You know, those are real concerns, you know, but I think a lot of it is in how you present the information and how you, you know, again, it gets back to the processes and procedures and, you know, how you tell them to use it in their jobs, right? And so that's how it is in that SKHR. This is a recommendation. However, you know, you need to look at this in the context of this person, you know, you're dealing with and how they're performing and all that, right? It's just basing the information on, you know, maybe some performance ratings and plus, you know, general, you know, information out there in the world on, you know, employment stats.
So that kind of hits on an interesting topic around responsibility. In that instance, whom is responsible for the AI output?
That's an interesting topic. I mean, the AI output that is, you know, part of that particular tool, you know, IBM takes responsibility for that. However, it is very clear when we are making employment decisions that it's the manager that's making that decision, right? It's extremely clear. It's very clear that this is just guidelines based upon statistical data, right?
Yeah. And I will say it was a little bit of a trick question. AIM's official stance is it's always a shared responsibility. The AI application itself is blameless. It's literally math and data. You can't blame a computer and you can't blame math.
Yeah.
But I think it's a shared responsibility between the AI developer and the users. And
Interesting. Yeah. You know, IBM is creating their own model and they are indemnifying that model, you know, which is interesting. I'm not, you know, this is not my main area of focus. So I won't claim to understand all the legal ins and outs of all of that, but those are the kind of conversations and things that, you know, that we're seeing and that customers are, you know, they're like, oh, okay, that's actually, you know, that gives me a little more confidence that, you know, you're backing this model. But yeah, I mean, how that would actually plays out in practice of, it's not quite clear to me, but
ultimately it's your decision, your work product. I feel like you can't pass the buck on that.
Absolutely.
The decision to use that salary recommendation to change someone's compensation and benefits. And you are the manager.
You are the manager. You are making the decision. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I have had some, an analyst in our industry has said that can sometimes actually be one of the barriers to AI adoption because organizations are having trouble figuring out the liability and where the blame lies. Can't really sue an AI application, but you can certainly terminate someone who maybe violated policies or made a bad decision.
Yeah.
But I also don't think that's the healthiest way to look at like AI adoption.
I don't either.
Who do we blame?
You know, Who do you blame? Right. You know, it's like blaming other tools that help you do your job. Right. You know, it's like, that's, you know.
Yeah. Which again, I think it's nice that you're focused on how do I fill in the gaps? How do I increase productivity? Because to me, that's that's kind of like the lower risk areas. It's the most benefit, most opportunity, and less risk because it was something that wasn't being done that could help the organization. And you can't
jump from that all the way to, oh, everything's just done for you, right? You
know? Yeah, no.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
And how do you, last couple of questions here, but I do want to ask you, how do enterprises experiment with this, with AI in a really safe way? Is it coming up with like a discrete use case? What does that look like for an organization?
Yeah, I mean, what we recommend is that people start with use cases. So yes, you know, you start with looking at, well, you know, how might I apply this? And then you look for what I would call pretty easy ways to do that. And, you know, vendors, including IBM, are making that easier, you know? So as an example, you know, in my area, we are providing it'll be in preview coming up in June here, but we are providing a pre-integrated, you know, connect your on-premise system to this service that will automatically allow you to, you know, from within your application, ask questions about a set of documents, right? And so it makes it super low barrier to entry. However, it's still using your own data, your documents, you know, to provide those answers, right? And so it's allowing you to kind of dip your feet in the water of trying a very simple use case and scenario. Mm-hmm. And so in that one, you may just be asking questions to get answers. And then, you know, maybe your next experiment is trying to, you know, do some of the things I was talking about where you're actually doing actions based upon those, upon what you're finding out, which again, is not all AI, right? That's a combination of AI with automation to actually get, you know, that work done. But that's what we recommend. Yeah. Put some smaller projects in place, you know, really look at measuring outcomes, you know, how is this actually helping you, you know, put that in place too. You know, I think, you know, what we're seeing in some of our studies that are, you know, we do at IBM, you know, is that many customers, they don't even know how much they're spending on this technology. They just have a lot of people out there, you know, just, you know, trying this and that. And so, yeah, definitely, you know, get a little more control around it, you know, starting small as always, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, building on that and absolutely starting with your use cases and make sure you can measure it.
Love that. Okay, last question. What should information leaders be thinking about right now to be successful in the next, let's say, 2 to 3 years?
Yeah. I mean, I think what we just said is really it, right? I mean, it was this, you know, this is a wave, you know, there's a lot of hype around Gen AI, but it is real, you know, it is real. And there are benefits to be had. And, you know, I think that the folks who implement it and apply it are going to be in a better place than those who don't. And so, you know, start small, do some of these smaller use cases. There's more and more out there now, you know, vendors are providing the ability to start small. You don't have to be a gigantic bank building all your own models, you know, doing everything. You know, you can use some of these tools to start smaller. So that would be my
wise advice. Lauren, thank you so much for doing this and being on AIM on Air. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really excited about next week at AIM and look forward to seeing you there.
Thanks, Lauren.